Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the last day of voting in the California recall election following last night's rally, at which President Biden was stumping for Gavin Newsom, calling the governor's right-wing talk show host challenger Larry Elder a Trump clone, while making it clear the outcome has national repercussions. Joining us is Larry Gersten, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at San Jose State University and a political analyst for NBC Television in the California Bay Area. He's the author of a number of books, including California Politics and Government, A Practical Approach, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California, and Recall, California's Political Earthquake. We will discuss Elder's Trumpian claim that he has detected fraud, even though the votes have yet to be counted, and the possibility that if Newsom has a strong showing, Democrats will move to reform the state's recall process, which is blatantly undemocratic and easily gamed for partisan purposes. Then we'll get an analysis of the all-or-nothing nature of the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill, into which the Democrats have stuffed all of their priorities in order to get around the Senate filibuster, but in doing so risk ending up with nothing to run on in 2022 unless the progressives and moderates can find a way to reconcile their differences, because their chances of holding the House and Senate are already slim. Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is Three Key Divides in Democrats' Civil War Over the Biden Agenda, joins us. Then finally, we'll get an update on the once oil-rich state of Venezuela, now having lost over 15% of its population, who have fled hyperinflation, food and medicine shortages, and political repression. Joining us from Caracas is Virginia Lopez, who was a correspondent for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English, and has a recent article at The New York Times, Venezuela's New Lettuce-Based Economy is Good Enough for Now, which points out that remittances in dollars, called lettuces in code, from those who have fled are propping up the unpopular government of Maduro. And joining us now is Larry Gersten, who is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at San Jose State University and a political analyst for NBC Television in the California Bay Area. He's the author of a number of books, including California Politics and Government, A Practical Approach, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California, and Recall, California's Political Earthquake. Welcome to Background Briefing, Larry Gersten.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Larry. And do you think that the political earthquake will be a minor tremor on the Richter scale if the polls are correct in predicting a pretty comfortable victory for Newsom tonight?
Newsom looks in pretty good shape as far as we know. What we don't know is the kind of turnout that we're going to have today. About 9 million votes have come in out of the 22 million that were sent. I think we can figure out, expect somewhere between about 2 and 4 million votes today, maybe 2 and 5 million. And the question is, do they come in the way they've been coming in? Is there going to be a wave in the other direction? We know that Republicans are expected to vote by about a 3-to-1 margin today over Democrats. We also know that Democrats outnumber Republicans by a 2-to-1 margin. So there are all kinds of machinations out there. And for the moment, most of them seem to point green for Newsom.
So what did you make of the rally last night in Long Beach, where President Biden was stumping for Newsom? And he called his right-wing talk show host challenger, Larry Elder, a Trump clone. But he also made it very clear that this race has national repercussions.
Well, Trump has been represented in California. There's no question about that in the name of Larry Elder. The interesting thing is that the Trump name was invoked by Gavin Newsom for months. But Trump himself had said virtually nothing about this campaign until a week or two ago. Only then, and Elder, who, by the way, once upon a time, said that he thought the 2020 election was fair and reasonable, and Biden won, did a 180, completely reversed himself, and has attached himself at the hip to Donald Trump. But that's all recent. It's all in the last week or two. And it's fair to suggest that it may well be that Elder has taken this route. The election is going to be rigged if I lose. As not only a page from the Trump playbook, but basically his rationalization for a loss that might occur.
So Elder has announced that he detected fraud in the California recall vote, but the vote hasn't been counted. So what is that statement based on? Do you know?
This is the page out of Trump. He said that in 2016, before the election. He said, if I lose, it's because it's rigged. He said it in 2020, before the votes had even started coming in. If I lose, it'll be because it's rigged. Elder is using the same approach. There were no evidences whatsoever of Trump being a victim of widespread fraud in 2016 and 2020, and we have no evidence that there's any fraud that has occurred to date. I don't know how anyone could determine there's fraud before any votes are even counted, and even that, California system is very, very well developed and extraordinarily secure.
Well, they were going on about Elder. First of all, Gavin Newsom had to speak extemporaneously for some time because President Biden was running late. But eventually when he got on stage, Biden also trashed Elder. I didn't hear either of them talking that much about why we should vote to keep Governor Newsom. What do you think, Larry?
Throughout this campaign, there has been a two-pronged approach by the Newsom folks. One, I've done a great job managing COVID. We're distributing funds where necessary to help people with their difficulties, be they unemployed people, business people, anybody else along the way, homeless people. And the second being that initially the Republicans are going to set the state back, and that as the Elder campaign has come into focus, that Larry Elder, being an acolyte of Donald Trump, is going to, if he's elected, will lead the way toward reversing all of the good policies that have been passed in California. The Elder thing really didn't take off until the polls began to show Elder, a late entrant, mind you, going to the top. And Elder has given Newsom a gift because we know that California is not enamored with Trump. Trump received 34% of the vote in 2020. And so putting Elder and Trump together for Newsom, that was the gift that Elder provided by the kind of strategy, the Trump strategy that he employed. It's hard to imagine that Newsom would be as well off as he is had Elder not come in with guns blaring in Trump's form.
And again, I'm speaking with Larry Gersten, who's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at San Jose State University and a political analyst for NBC Television in the California Bay Area. He's the author of a number of books, including California Politics and Government, A Practical Approach, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California, and Recall, California's Political Earthquake. So, Larry, do you think you're going to have a late night tonight on television as the count comes
it'll
in?
It'll be a late night tonight, but it won't be. It probably won't be over tonight. It all depends on how they determine the ballots that they're going to count and where they come from. This is the first time, actually the second time, when all the ballots have been distributed to every single registered voter in this state. We did it in 2020 with the beginning of COVID. And we've done it again now. COVID's still with us. The idea being that everybody should get a ballot. By the way, that will probably be an assistance to Newsom. The more ballots are in people's homes, the easier it is for them to vote in special elections. The Democrats particularly tend not to vote as much as the Republicans. So that in itself, that change in policy will probably be of help to him. But counting, 12, 13, 14 million votes will not be done right away. It'll take a couple of days. So we may have an idea tonight as to what's going on. If Republicans came in, guns blaring today, to vote heavily, whatever people might have thought, could be delayed a bit, especially if those votes are counted first. So there are variables out there that we just can't possibly anticipate. But we should hopefully get a solid number of votes tonight. We just don't know how representative they'll be of the voters at large.
But the recall itself is the only mechanism by which Republicans could pick up any kind of major state office in the state of California, right? I mean, that makes
certainly
it
right now.
Kind
yes,
of underhand
right
way. Many analysts have pointed out how undemocratic it is that Newsom, what did he win by in the last election? 62% or something? Or more than that, wasn't it?
He won 62-38. I think it was a 24 percentage margin. And you're right. I mean, it takes 50% plus one to recall the governor, and it takes whatever plurality exists. That is to say, the person who gets more votes than anybody else. With 46 candidates out there this time around, it's conceivable that someone could win with 20% of the vote, maybe even less. Republicans are voting very firmly for Elder. We've seen some tentative data out already. 57% of the Republicans who have voted have suggested that they voted for Elder. And that's good, considering there's so many other Republican candidates out there. There's two dozen Republican candidates. So he's definitely solidified the Republican vote in his camp. According to the data that's out there, at least for now, 24% of the independents have voted for Elder. So we'll see. We just don't know whether the votes that are announced tonight will be representative. We know that the Bay Area voted very heavily, very quickly in the first couple of weeks. And so the votes coming in appear to be so one-sided. Well, what happens when Orange County comes in? What happens when Central Valley comes in? What happens when the extreme north of California comes in? We just don't know. We know that those votes should be somewhat more so for Elder than Newsom, but it's going to be a tall hill to climb as to whether they can offset that 2-to-1 Democratic voter registration advantage.
Well, given that Larry Elder is a radio talk show host, and there's an old joke that radio is show business for ugly people, and I'm not suggesting in any way that Larry Elder is ugly, but he is not telegenic. I saw his TV ads, and they were not effective at all. In fact, they were very amateurish and kind of, I thought he wasn't making eye contact. He seemed nervous. It didn't work. So there's some other reason that has nothing to do with the normal campaign factors that go into electing a candidate. The reason that the Republicans are voting en masse for him is what, do you think, Larry?
Well, Elder does have a following. He's got 2.5 million followers. He's got this national television show, and that show is heard all over the state. He may not be telegenic, but that's not going to keep him from getting a lot of votes. Look, there is a group of people out there who will vote against Newsom, period. They will vote against Newsom. They don't like Newsom. They think Newsom is too liberal, whether it's gun control, homelessness, you name it. There's a series of issues. They don't like he kept kids out of school. They don't like that he's required masks. And those folks will vote against him on principle. They'll vote yes. And so then they're going to choose, well, who do we want? Most of those people are not well known. They're just not. And a couple of Republicans who are better known have rather narrow constituencies. So here comes Larry Elder, and at a point when people are going to choose him no matter what, choose somebody no matter what, they'll choose someone who's got better name recognition. At least a number of them will.
So what is Biden talking about last night when he kept suggesting that this race had national implications and for Californians to take it seriously because it is a big deal? That's what he kept saying. What is it that he's saying?
Yes, Newsom has made this point, and I think a number of people watching the election have accepted it as a point. If Larry Elder wins, he's going to reverse the mandates. If Larry Elder wins, he will fight for legislation that overturns Roe versus Wade. If Larry Elder wins, He's going to walk away from the homelessness problem in California. And all of these things are Larry Elder's comments. They're his words. If Larry Elder wins, he's going to do what he can to undo any legislation on climate change. Well, all these are California issues, but they're also national issues. And so the point that Biden and Newsom have been making is that if you put Larry Elder in, that's a precursor to the kinds of policies that will pass in other states, because Republicans there will get the idea that they can do what's been done in California. We already have two states, for example, Wisconsin and Michigan, that are what we call recall states, just like California. And the thinking is, if Larry Elder wins here, Republicans there will be enthusiastic enough to try to go out there and turn those two states over. So there are plenty of reasons for people, Democrat and Republican, to view this as a national type of a race, even though it's only in California. Remember, California is the largest state in the union. California has 20% of the votes it takes to win a presidential election. So as California goes in this case, a number of people believe the nation will follow.
So, Larry, just in the last couple of minutes then, what happens, though, after this election? I mean, let's assume that Newsom wins handily. Will that give Democrats an impetus to reform this recall system? Because it's been made clear, and you just made the point earlier in this interview, how undemocratic this process is. And it's also clear that it's being gamed by the Republicans. So do you expect a reform of some kind of this recall process?
Hard to know. We know this. The only way you can reform this process is through a constitutional amendment. That's how it arrived here in 1913. That's how it has to go away, with an amendment that basically undoes this amendment or replaces this amendment. It's not hard to get those on the ballot. The question is, 2, 4, 6 years down the road, when this issue is not in the public eye like it is right now, how many people will be as enthusiastic about it? And also the question is, what kind of reforms do you want to make? Are you going to go ahead and raise the percentage of the voters needed to sign a petition? Are you going to get rid of the second ballot? Are you going to allow the governor to run as a replacement candidate? I mean, there are several criticisms, and I'm not sure that enough people agree on the same one, much less ones. So I don't think it's automatic at all that there'll be a change. I think, in my opinion, there should be several changes. But the voters, you know, once the light is gone from this issue, it gets pretty dark. And it's hard to know it's hard to feel that the anger of the public is there, number one, and number two, whether they will actually translate that into a movement to recall the election. I would say one other thing. You started that question by saying if Newsom wins big, I think it's another thing. Newsom has to win big to help his chances for next year, because if he just squeaks through, barely makes it, two things will happen. There'll be a number of Democrats out there who say, aha, I've got to jump in. He's not strong enough. And Republicans will be absolutely feel validated. Aha, we got close. We're going to go in full guns blaring. Remember, Newsom raised $80 million this year. Can he do that again next year? Yes, California is a bit of an ATM when it comes to elections. That's asking a lot. So there are lots of issues out there that go well beyond tonight. But first of all, we've got to get through tonight.
Well, Larry Gersten, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Larry Gersten, who's a professor emeritus of political science at San Jose State University and a political analyst for NBC Television in the California Bay Area. He's the author of a number of books, including California Politics and Government, A Practical Approach, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California, and Recall, California's Political Earthquake. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of the all-or-nothing nature of the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill. I like to rest. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is Three Key Divides in Democrats' Civil War Over the Biden Agenda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Levitz.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And your article, let me quote the setup here. The Biden presidency is on the cusp of achieving the largest expansion of the American welfare state in many decades, the largest investment in climate change mitigation in U.S. history, the first pro-union revision to American labor law in a generation, drug pricing reforms that eluded his Democratic predecessors, a large progressive tax increase, bipartisan infrastructure investments, a major expansion of public education, and much more. And yet, the fate of all these measures rests on the passage of a single, solitary bill. So, how did this happen, that the Democrats have put themselves in a situation where it's all or nothing?
Yeah, it's a kind of bizarre circumstance. As I mentioned in the piece, there really is no precedent that comes readily to mind for the circumstance that we have at this moment, where really the entirety, at least of his economic agenda, Biden's economic agenda, now rests on this single piece of legislation. And it's kind of a product of, one, just the thinness of the Democratic Party's majorities in the House and Senate, two, sort of arcane Senate rules and procedures and traditions, and three, the fact that Democrats don't think that they have especially good odds of retaining the House past 2022. Anyway. So this is how you end up with all of these policies in one bucket. Because Democrats have this fragile grip on power, every interest group within the coalition knows that it's probably now or never for the priorities that they have been trying to get past. Many of them didn't get their chance under Obama to have the ball moved on their issue. So for decades, they've been waiting for these changes. Something like paid family leave has been a century-long struggle. And so if it were the case that Democrats thought they had an excellent chance of keeping or expanding their congressional majorities come 2023, then progressives might be willing to stand down for now and accept a more narrow policy, or at least would not be so worried that moderates are going to hold out on them that they're refusing to vote for this bipartisan infrastructure bill that Biden has already secured in a separate legislation. Right now, that bill is in the House, and it's not going to get a vote in the House until this other larger bill is ready, because the progressives fear that the moment they vote for the bipartisan bill, moderates might suddenly abandon their support for this larger spending bill. Whereas if they hold off and give the moderates a binary choice, look, either you're going to vote for all of Biden's economic priorities, or you're going to condemn him to be a complete failure as a president, because if you don't support the bigger bill, we'll vote against the bipartisan one. So these things together have produced a situation where if Democrats cannot reach basically unanimity, almost unanimity, on this larger legislative package, the reconciliation bill, Biden's entire agenda collapses.
But it doesn't do any of the Democrats any good if Biden collapses. Don't they go down with the sinking ship as well? You've already made it clear that they fear they won't hold the House in 2022 or 2023, and probably the same with the Senate.
That's right. I mean, it's a game of chicken between the moderates and the progressives for that reason. The moderates think that, you know, I mean, both sides have an investment in avoiding the outcome of, you know, the total collapse. And so it's a question of who's going to blink first as far as, you know, I think basically it's ultimately going to come down to, you know, there's some things about the fine details of the legislation, but the big fight is about the size. And the question is going to be, you know, where they land between Joe Manchin has suggested that he would support maybe a $1.5 trillion bill, whereas progressives see the $3.5 trillion, which is where it's at right now, as a compromise already from, you know, what they had envisioned. And so the idea is that the moderates think that, for the reason you state, progressives won't really go through with it and vote against the bipartisan bill if they're given a choice between passing the bipartisan infrastructure bill and a $1.5 trillion supplementary bill or getting nothing, that they won't go for nothing. But progressives have the same sort of the alternative view, which is that moderates, if given the choice between voting for a $3.5 trillion bill and the bipartisan bill or getting nothing, they'll support the larger bill. So it's just this game of chicken between those two different factions.
And of course, the $3.5 trillion is a compromise. Bernie Sanders, the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, wanted $6 trillion initially. So he feels he's compromised. And he's also pointed out that what are we doing here? We're building bridges so that people can sleep under them?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's important to contextualize that the $3.5 trillion, that is over a 10-year period. So it's not analogous to the big stimulus bills that we've had the last couple of years. We've gotten used to seeing, you know, the CARES Act was $2.2 trillion. The American Jobs Plan passed earlier this year was $1.9 trillion. But those were bills that released spending, you know, within like a sort of almost all in a one-year time frame, right? So if we were characterizing the price of this bill in similar terms, you know, it's arguable that it might be better described as $350 billion bill, because in terms of per year, that's what it's spending. So I think there's a little bit of confusion in that regard, because, you know, this is not that wild an amount of money to be investing in, you know, climate infrastructure and just providing really basic and kind of not terribly generous versions of social welfare programs that exist in every other major developed country. You know, so we're the only country in the OECD that has no national paid family leave program. I think us and like Papua New Guinea are the only countries, I think, in the OECD that don't have them. Our system is closer to Papua New Guinea's than it is to Britain's. And, you know, similar can be said for our lack of any kind of child allowance or, you know, significant federal child care program. So progressives have good reason to think that this is, you know, $3.5 trillion should be the compromise. But the moderates are trying to leverage the fact that they maybe have less investment in the Democratic Party's success. You know, Joe Manchin represents a state that is overwhelmingly pro-Trump. He may feel whatever, that he may have less to lose from the collapse of the Biden presidency than some others do, perhaps. But I don't know. It's basically this showdown, and it's unclear where the final number is going to end up.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is Three Key Divides in Democrats' Civil War Over the Biden Agenda. Well, if Manchin wants to cut the $3.5 trillion down to take $2 trillion out of it, in fact, down to $1.5, you know, he's citing the deficit. Well, that's a bogus argument if you're going to pay for it with taxes, and that's where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? You've got these so-called moderates. They're not necessarily listening to the rank-and-file voters. Aren't they listening to their donors?
Yeah, so one of the things, you know, those divides that you mentioned in the headline of my piece, one that I focus on is that, you know, there are some moderate Democrat is kind of a catch-all term, and there's a lot of diversity among Democrats who don't identify as progressive. And, you know, some of these moderates really do, or at least, you know, it varies a bit from issue to issue, right? But there are some moderates who are really focused on, you know, centrists who are really trying to occupy the middle ground in terms of public opinion. And then there are other moderates who are trying to pursue political safety by attaching themselves or getting on the right side of really big pocketed interest groups and businesses that can afford to spend a lot of money either to help them or to hurt them in their districts.
Well, that's what you point out. I mean, the best example is in your article, where on Monday the Ways and Means Committee unveiled a draft proposal for empowering Medicaid to negotiate drug prices with insurers, since that's been a racket for the longest time. This is incredibly popular with the American people. By 88%, even 77% of Republican voters support it. But the moderate Democrats have found a way to allow Medicaid to crack down on generic drug monopolies instead of where the real problem is. And in some cases, aren't they deferring the implementation of these drug pricing measures until 2025?
Yeah, so the drug price reforms are a great example because they are probably maybe the most popular proposal within this whole Biden agenda. There might be a couple of things up there, but it's pretty close. It's not only extremely popular, it reduces the deficit, right? Because if Medicare forces drug prices down, that saves the government money. It also, you know, Manchin has talked about being concerned about inflation, and other moderate Democrats have invoked inflation. Well, this directly lowers prices, right? For a good that's very highly salient. Polls consistently show not only is there overwhelming support for this, but it's not one of those things where voters say they support it because it sounds good to them, but they don't really care about it. This is something that voters want Congress to prioritize. A lot of senior citizens are having trouble affording their medications. So it hits all these things that moderates sort of claim to care about: public opinion, the deficit, inflation. Nonetheless, there are a significant faction of moderate Democrats that have been trying to nix this proposal. And there's a different faction of moderate Democrats that actually has been pushing for its inclusion because they know that it's popular and because they're in swing districts where there are a lot of older voters and where they want to deliver this for them. And so there's been this really interesting rift between self-styled moderates of different persuasions. Now, to some extent, this is not a rift between people who are invariably attentive to public opinion and invariably deferential to corporate interests. Some of it can be attributed to an issue-by-issue thing where representatives who might otherwise go with the popular proposal but represent districts or states in which Big Pharma has a really big footprint, where they employ a lot of people or where they have a headquarters and they really care about, you know, exercising sway in this particular area, those Democrats tend to be more deferential than average to pharma. And then you see this on other issues where every sort of district and state has its own kind of entrenched corporate interests. But there are some, nonetheless, that all that said, there are some moderate Democrats who are conspicuously have a greater tendency towards deferring to corporations rather than to the will of the voters.
But another example that you have in your article, Eric Levitt's Three Key Divides in Democrat Civil War Over the Biden Agenda, is the SALT tax, the state and local tax that the Republicans put in the Trump tax cuts of 2017. It was deliberately designed to hurt Democrats and Democratic donors in blue states like California and New York, where the Republicans put a $10,000 cap on the amount of state and local taxes that wealthy Americans can deduct from their federal tax bills. And out here in Hollywood, I've met a number of people in the who earn between $5 and $10 million a year, and this is really hurting them. So isn't that also posing a dilemma for the Democrats, whether or not to repeal it or raise the cap? Because it does mean taking money away from the $3.5 trillion, which is needed to be paid for with raising in taxes, and already the House Ways and Means Committee have come short at $2.9 trillion.
Yeah, you know, SALT is this issue where it affects a minority of the Democratic caucus because the places where this is really salient are limited. It's in really high tax blue states, especially New York, New Jersey, and California. And so, you know, that's going to be a minority of the overall Democratic caucus. At the same time, in those places, this is an extremely salient issue to a very influential voting bloc. And it not only concerns that voting bloc, but concerns the state's business communities, and to a certain extent, some of the state's progressives even, because if wealthy people and businesses in states can write off their state taxes on their federal returns, then you're kind of being able to tap into the federal deficit financing. Basically, you're putting some of your spending on the federal deficit, and that allows you to, in these blue states, do a much higher level of social welfare spending and redistribution without incurring a really significant backlash among wealthy voters and or relocation of, you know, corporations across state lines. That still happens a little bit, but this really mitigates it. And so there is a very intense support for it among this 30-member SALT caucus that is threatening to, their motto is something like no SALT, no bill. They're going to collectively vote against and kill the bill. It's another one of these situations where another group is trying to, pretend they're going to shoot the baby in order to get a ransom demand. And again, as you suggested, this is a problem where if there were no deficit hawks in the party, and if there were no representatives who were allergic to significant or had a very limited tolerance for raising taxes on the rich, besides this one, then you could see Democrats and progressives getting on board with repealing the SALT cap. But that's not the case. We're in a situation where they have only, maybe they have $3.5 trillion at best, maybe more realistically, perhaps after these negotiations, they'll have, maybe 2.5, who knows? So it's a very limited, and that $3.5 trillion was initially budgeted. When it was literally budgeted, SALT cap repeal was not included. And SALT cap repeal costs nearly $400 billion. So if you give in to the SALT caucus, your math problem between the progressives and moderates gets even more difficult. And so nonetheless, the SALT caucus is influential enough that it seems like they're going to get something, raising the cap of the amount that you can deduct rather than getting rid of it. But it's a real point of tension and another one of these internal issues that they need to sort out if they're going to find a compromise.
Well, just in closing, Eric Levitz, it seems that the Republicans promise their donors that they'll cut their taxes, and the Democrats promise their donors that they won't raise their taxes. And every time there's been a tax raise, whether it's George W. Bush's promise, read my lips, and Clinton raised taxes and lost an enormous number of House seats in the midterms, and so did Obama as well in 2010. So it's not as if these Democrats who are worried about raising taxes don't have a case, right? I mean, something about the American people, they don't like raising taxes. And this is not just the plutocrats. This is average folks as well, isn't it?
Yeah, taxing the very, very rich polls consistently well and sometimes does well at the ballot box in terms of ballot referendums. It's complicated. But in general, raising taxes on the middle class is really politically toxic in this country. And,
Well, Biden's made that clear, that nobody earning up to $400,000 will have their taxes raised. But yeah. Is it working, just in closing?
Is it working in terms of, I think that the moderates are right to be afraid in terms of, like, presidents almost always lose a lot of seats in midterm elections. And to the extent that they do support tax changes that the Chamber of Commerce vehemently opposes, that could attract more money into their districts, super PAC money, all kinds of money running ads against them. So I think that they have reason to fear targeted ads at them. I don't think that they have reason to fear that a really large section of their electorate is going to be mad that, taxes were raised on Jeff Bezos or whatever.
Sure. No, but that's our money-driven political system at work, isn't it, Eric? So I thank you for joining us.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is Three Key Divides in Democrats' Civil War Over the Biden Agenda. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an update from the once oil-rich state of Venezuela, now having lost over 15% of its population, who have fled hyperinflation, food and medicine shortages, and political repression.
So I will ask you one. Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Venezuela is Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English, who has a recent article at The New York Times, Venezuela's New Lettuce-Based Economy is Good Enough for Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. It's been a while since we spoke, and your article points out that in 2017, the average Venezuelan reported losing an average of 24 pounds because of food shortages. But things are turning around because of a lettuce-based economy, so you really have to explain that.
So basically, since the time when there were these, you know, horrible food shortages, the economy became informally dollarized. This wasn't a formal policy by the Maduro government. This sort of just happened spontaneously. And a couple of years into it, we are beginning to basically see that it's worked and that, you know, things are beginning to stabilize. Maduro also lifted import tariffs, which, of course, has its catches. But for now, in a country that was, you know, starving, it's really sort of turned things around for the people, of course, who have access to dollars. And when I say it's a lettuce-based economy is because, you know, a lot of these things are informal. They're not official formal policy. And oftentimes they were illegal. So the word lettuce became code word for dollars. So, yeah, basically we live in this very strange economy.
Well, but isn't it ironic to think that you're depending upon the U.S. dollar as your lifeline at the same time that the U.S. government is crippling the country with sanctions? And the irony here, of course, what you pointed out in your New York Times article, Venezuela's new lettuce-based economy is good enough for now, is that the dollar economy has helped keep Maduro in power.
Exactly. I mean, it's a lot of the reasons why this economy is at all possible is because so many Venezuelans have left the country and they're now helping to sustain their relatives who still, you know, remain in the country with remittances. So, yeah, it's a terrible, tragic irony that the people who had to flee the country either because of repression or just, you know, dire economic conditions are now helping to prop the very government that forced them to take, you know, to leave the country. Yeah, it's a terrible irony.
Well, but there is a certain another irony here, surely, that what in many ways keeps Maduro in power is the fact that the Cuban intelligence service seems to have a grip on the country and has for the longest time, and has made sure that the Venezuelan military stays on board with Maduro. I mean, it's a very strange case of the tail wagging the dog. But given that Cuba itself is a basket case, dependent upon remittances from exiled Cubans too, there's an irony there, isn't it? That the tail that wags the dog has exported its same economic model.
Absolutely. There's other sort of angles to it. For example, you know, the fact that Venezuela had at one point a very sort of powerful oil industry that was helping Cuba with subsidies and free petrol, basically, is now in tatters and they're no longer producing what they used to produce is affecting Cuba even worse than it is Venezuela. You know, I think a lot of the crisis that is hitting Cuba now has to do with a lack of oil subsidies that they no longer have from Venezuela. So, you know, it's a very complex story. And the military, of course, you know, and these sanctions somehow have actually made the military feel more loyal towards Maduro, because the idea that not only are they targeted by individual sanctions, but also that they could face legal proceedings in the U.S. means that they feel like, you know, with Maduro in power, they're safer.
But there is, of course, a dark side to what's happening in Venezuela, and that is the extent to which Venezuela is becoming an export hub for cocaine, particularly. I mean, we learned about it, ironically, from a mafia boss in Turkey who had escaped and was broadcasting very popular videos exposing the high levels in the Erdogan government in Turkey. And he was exposing contacts, high-level contacts, with some of Erdogan's top cronies and importing cocaine from Venezuela that then went on to Europe. So what's happening there in terms of the drug trade? It does seem that that is also a big part of what's keeping Maduro going.
You know, I've never really seen that these accusations are properly substantiated. It's a story that I've purposely not wanted to cover, not only because it's incredibly dangerous for me as a journalist here, but also because the times in which I have began to look into it, it's a really sort of bogus, you know, story. In fact, they just captured one of the former intelligence chiefs, and the accusations against him seem to sort of morph from at first originally being very serious, you know, drug charges to now being something slightly milder, serving as a midpoint between the Colombian guerrilla FARC guerrillas and the Venezuelan government, which, you know, technically really isn't illegal. So, you know, I haven't seen credible proof about these accusations in the 20 years that I've been reporting from Venezuela. I think if anything, you could probably say that Venezuela has turned a blind eye to the trafficking and that it's served as a transit point. But, you know, Colombia is the producer. Venezuela doesn't really produce any cocaine.
And again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English, and she has a recent article at The New York Times, Venezuela's New Lettuce-Based Economy is Good Enough for Now. So the other story that I wanted to follow up on you, since we haven't spoken for a while, is the extent to which parts of Venezuela, and particularly parts of Caracas, have become sort of no-go zones where local sort of gangs, militias or whatever they are, control neighborhoods that even the government itself can't penetrate, even those loyal to Maduro. Is that what's happening, at least in the capital city?
There have been many reports about Venezuela's, you know, increasing lawlessness, certainly around, you know, across the border into Colombia and Brazil. And you're absolutely right. These are areas that, you know, are not sort of known for the rule of law, so to speak. And in Caracas also, there's certain sort of shanty towns or favelas, as they say in Brazil, that sort of have a bit of a government of their own, if you wish. And there was a very sort of dramatic incident over 3 weeks ago with a two-day-long clash between security forces and the local gangs. So, yeah, no, that's an increasingly worrisome situation. The government was able to control, and the gang leader is now in hiding. They didn't really capture him. So it's, you know, I think that there's a potential for a resurgence of this type of incident again. It's becoming more and more frequent.
But in terms of what you've written about in the New York Times, Virginia Lopez, Venezuela's new lettuce-based economy is good enough for now, the idea that Hugo Chavez's socialism has now morphed into what you describe as Mr. Maduro's tropical brand of haphazard capitalism. Again, it is ironic, but something close to, 20% of the population has now fled the country and they're sending dollars back. But the persistent problem seems to be that there's never been any sufficiently organized, I guess, opposition. And even though the United States and a lot of European countries recognize Juan Guaido, he's not proven to be that effective. Certainly other opposition leaders have been less effective. What is the problem there in terms of countering Maduro? This is a man who's taken an oil-rich country into penury. I mean, it's an extraordinary... I mean, only Mugabe in Zimbabwe has a worse record than Maduro, and yet he's still in power. So what explains that?
Well, I have to start by saying that it's a complete mystery to me that this opposition that has been the opposition for 20 years hasn't really learned from its own mistakes and hasn't really, you know, been successful at capitalizing the discontent that the country feels towards the government. It's, you know, it shall remain a mystery to me. We are now up against regional elections, and instead of coming together as a united front and, you know, choosing the best candidates, the opposition continues to have these sort of internal spats, and candidates are being chosen, you know, to be perfectly honest, not so much on their popularity or even on their merits, but it seems to me that on their very selfish interests. So, you know, with an opposition like this, it just seems to me that the government can only get stronger. And it has. And I think also part of the problem is that the opposition continues to underestimate Maduro. Maduro, when the whole COVID-19 lockdown started, was one of the first leaders to shut down the country. He actually managed the crisis rather well. Venezuela defied all predictions, and unlike Brazil or Peru or even Ecuador, we never saw, you know, as high a number of the COVID deaths as these countries. He seemed, you know, to be in firm grip of the situation. He also mobilized the military and garnered their support. So, you know, he's emerging from these crises, not only the political and economic, but now the pandemic, as a strong leader. People don't necessarily like him. He's got, you know, there's a high level of discontent. Like I said, it's impossible to deny that. But they also don't like Guaido, and they also see the opposition as being very opportunistic and even corrupt. So even the moral battle, which the opposition had at some point won, and they've now lost. So, you know, with all those losses, it's really difficult to keep on demanding of the civil society that they mobilize and support them. It's, I don't know if irony as much as tragedy would probably be the correct term.
Well, the U.S., of course, still backs Guaido, and so do the Europeans, and I think most countries around the world do. And Venezuela is supported by, again, Cuba, which just seems to be the tail that wags the dog in keeping Maduro in power. And then you've got Iran and Turkey, as I mentioned earlier. They are also supporters. So U.S. policy towards Venezuela has clearly failed. As a Venezuelan, what would you hope to see from the United States?
I think that it would probably be beneficial to try and get a very sort of serious round of negotiations going on, one where both parts are committed to an electoral calendar where we are guaranteed free and fair elections. That's certainly, you know, the one goal that the U.S. has put forth that seems to make sense to the Venezuelans. Nobody wants an invasion, you know, this idea that Trump kept on repeating that all options were on the table or that he was going to exert, you know, sort of maximum pressure march was something that, you know, very few Venezuelans could agree with. Certainly, you know, what the messes that we've seen in the recent past seem to, you know, fill us with relief that we never went the route that Trump seems to have designed for us. I think that the U.S., you know, should continue to provide spaces for Venezuelans to reach their own conclusions and, you know, and try and push for a free and fair election. And, you know, I think they also need to consider re-engaging with the Maduro government. They've proven to have won this battle. It's the truth. Sanctions are not useful in any way at all. Maduro, again, has proven that he can bypass them in the same way as Iran and Cuba and all of these other sanctioned countries. I don't,
sure,
you know,
including Russia, by the way. Putin, correct, uses sanctions as an excuse to saying, look, it's not my problem, and the Americans are doing it to you, and the Russian people, you know, blame the Americans, not Putin. And I'm sure the Venezuelan people, to some extent, blame the Americans, not Maduro. Is that the case?
That's partly the case, yes. I mean, nobody's, you know, this isn't Maduro's greatest day either. People are not happy with the Maduro government. He's not popular. He's a strong ruler, but I wouldn't say he's, you know, popular or charismatic. But, you know, when people are faced with such dire economic conditions, politics kind of sort of falls to a second plane, you know, it's
but
just
in closing, Virginia, just in closing, do you think that the U.S. should abandon the sanctions?
I think that there should be a gradual lifting of sanctions that comes as a result of a negotiation that makes sense. I don't think that you can sort of lift all sanctions overnight.
You should lift them based on conditions.
Correct. Yeah, right. Correct. Absolutely.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Likewise. It's always a pleasure to be on your program, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. And she has a recent article at the New York Times, Venezuela's New Lettuce-Based Economy is Good Enough for Now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One time.